And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's November 16th. Very interesting day. Just got word that a good friend of mine, Leon Metz, who is 90 years old, died. He was probably the best known historian in this area. And the media, in its typical ignorant fashion, quoted somebody who went out of his way to damage Leon, took his radio show away from him. His name is Bernie Sargent. Well, it's November 16th, as I said, 320th day of the year. Leap year is 321st. 45 days remain to the end of the year. On this day in history, in 951, Emperor Li Jing sends a southern Tang expeditionary force of 10,000 men under Bian Hao to conquer Chu. Lin Qing removes the ruling family to his own capital, in Nanjing, ending the Chu kingdom. 1272, while traveling during the Ninth Crusade, Prince Edward becomes King of England when Henry III died. But he won't go back to England for nearly 2 years to assume the throne. Now, this next one is an example of official ignorance. In 1491, an auto de fe held in a Brasero de la Dehesa outside Avila concludes the case of the Holy Child of LaGuardia. There's a public execution of several Jewish and converso suspects. The problem with it is the Holy Child of LaGuardia is a folk saint in Spanish Roman Catholicism, and the subject of a medieval blood libel in the town of LaGuardia in central Spanish province of Toledo. November 16th, 1491, an auto de fe, a ritual of public penance, which condemned heretics and apostates, was imposed by the Catholics. But it was held outside of Avila, ended in the public execution of several people. Suspects confessed under torture to murdering a child. Among the executed were Benito Garcia, the converso, initially confessed to the murder. Interestingly enough, nobody was ever found. There was no evidence a child disappeared or was even killed. And because of contradictory confessions, the court had trouble coherently depicting how this event took place. In fact, the child's very existence was disputed. Like Pedro de Arbues, the holy infant was quickly made into a saint by popular acclaim, and his death greatly assisted the Spanish Inquisition and its Inquisitor General, Tomas de Torquemada, in their campaign against heresy and crypto-Judaism. In fact, the cult of the holy infant still celebrated in LaGuardia. It's been called Spain's most infamous case of blood libel. The Holy Child was used as the pretext to expel Jews from Spain. It was all apparently made up. But when you got closed-minded, intolerant bigots, it doesn't take much. 1532, Francisco Pizarro and his men capture Inca Emperor Atahualpa at the Battle of Cajamarca. 1776, American Revolutionary War. British and Hessian units capture Fort Washington from the Patriots. 1793, French Revolution. 90 dissident Roman Catholic priests are executed by drowning at Nantes. See, the problem is in the French Revolution, they wanted to create a new religion, the worship of reason. In fact, the goddess of reason is, the Statue of Liberty that was given to us by France was in fact a reproduction of the goddess of reason. But such is the mindset of revolutionaries. 1797, the Prussian heir apparent, Frederick William, becomes King of Prussia, Frederick Wilhelm III. 1805, Napoleonic Wars, the Battle of Schellengraben. Russian forces under Peter Bagration, delayed the pursuit of by French troops under Joachim Murat. 1822, American Old West. Missouri trader William Becknell arrives in Santa Fe over a route that became known as the Santa Fe Trail. 1828, Greek War of Independence. The London Protocol entails the creation of an autonomous Greek state under Ottoman suzerainty, encompassing the Morea and the Cyclades. 1849, a Russian court sentences writer Fyodor Dostoevsky to death for anti-government activities linked to a radical intellectual group. The sentence is later commuted to hard labor. 1855, David Livingstone becomes the first European to see the Victoria Falls in what's now Zambia, Zimbabwe. 1857, the second relief of Lucknow. 24 Victoria Crosses are awarded, the most in a single day. 1859. The Siege of Lucknow was a prolonged defense of the residency in the city of Lucknow during the Indian Rebellion of 1857. After two successive relief attempts to reach the city, the defenders and the civilians were evacuated from the residency, which was then abandoned. The commanders are Sir Henry Lawrence, Brigadier John English, Sir Henry Havelock, Sir James Outram, Sir Colin Campbell, and James George Smith Neal. The British strength, well, actually the East India Company, was 1,729, eventually rose to 8,000. The Indian rebels had 5,000 and eventually raised to 30,000. Casualties among the East India Company was 2,500 killed, wounded, or missing. Nobody has any idea how many of the rebels were killed, wounded, or missing. 1863, American Civil War. In the Battle of Campbell's Station, Confederate troops unsuccessfully attack Union forces, which allows General Burnside to secure Knoxville, Tennessee. 1871, National Rifle Association gets its charter from New York State. 1885, Canadian rebel leader of the Métis and father of Manitoba, Louis Riel, is executed for treason. 1904, English engineer John Ambrose Fleming gets a patent for the thermionic valve, also known as a vacuum tube. 1907, Indian Territory and Oklahoma Territory joined to form Oklahoma, which is admitted as the 46th state of the Union. 1914, Federal Reserve Bank of the U.S. officially opens. 1920, Qantas, Australia's national airline, is founded as Queensland and Northern Territory Aerial Services Limited. 1933, the U.S. and the Soviet Union established formal diplomatic relations. 1938, LSD is first synthesized by Albert Hofmann from ergotamine at the Sandoz Laboratories in Basel. 1940, World War II, in response to the leveling of Coventry with the German Luftwaffe 2 days before, the Royal Air Force bombs Hamburg. 1940, the Holocaust. In occupied Poland, the Nazis close off the Warsaw Ghetto from the outside world. 1940, the New York City's mad bomber, George Matetsky, places his first bomb at a Manhattan office building used by Consolidated Edison. 1944, World War II. In the support of the Battle of Herkin Forest, the town of Durin is destroyed by Allied aircraft. 1945, UNESCO is founded. 1965, Venera program. Soviet Union launches Venera 3 space probe toward Venus, which would be the first spacecraft to reach the surface of another planet. 1973, Skylab. NASA launches Skylab 4 with a crew of 3 astronauts from Cape Canaveral, Florida, for an 84-day mission. 1973, U.S. President Richard Nixon signs the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act into law that authorizes the construction of the Alaska Pipeline. 1974, the Arecibo message is broadcast from Puerto Rico. It's a 1974 interstellar radio message carrying basic information about humanity and Earth, sent to the global star cluster M13. It was meant as a demonstration of human technological advancement rather than a real attempt to enter into a conversation with extraterrestrials. It was broadcast into space a single time via frequency-modulated radio waves at a ceremony to mark the remodeling of the Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico on this date in 1974. Okay, let's see what else we got. 1976, Renee McCrae and her son Andrew disappear from Inverness. The disappearance is currently Britain's longest-running missing persons case. She was a Scottish woman who'd been missing since 1976. Presumed to have been murdered, she and her 3-year-old son Andrew was disappeared. On September 11, 2019, William McDowell was charged with the murder of McCrae and her son. The bodies had never been found. Ray McCrae and her son lived in Inverness, was married to Gordon McCrae, although they were separated. She had 2 sons, actually, 9-year-old Gordon and 3-year-old Andrew. On November 12, 1976, she left her home in Cradle Hall with both her sons, dropped her elder son Gordon at her estranged husband's house and turned south onto the A9 in the direction of Perth to visit her sister in Kilmarnock. Neither have ever been seen again. Later that same night, 12 miles away, a train driver spotted McCrae's burning BMW in an isolated lay-by. When the police got there,
motion detected at the front door.
The car was charred and empty apart from a rug stained with blood matching McCrae's blood type. During the investigation, it became readily apparent McCrae's personal life was not straightforward. Around 1971, unbeknownst to her husband, she began an affair with William McDowell. He was married with 2 children and worked for Gordon McCrae as an accountant and company secretary. Gordon was her husband. Nobody knew about the affair except Valerie Steventon, McCrae's best friend. Steventon revealed McCrae hadn't been planning to visit her sister, but intended to travel to Perthshire to visit McDowell, who happened to be Andrew's biological father. And her husband didn't know that either. Well, McDowell admitted they had an affair, but refused to talk about any aspect of the case except to deny he had anything to do with it. But it is missing persons cases that are never solved are fascinating. 1979, the first line of Bucharest Metro is opened from Timpuri Noi to Simeonitoroa in Bucharest, Romania. 1988, Supreme Court of the Estonian Soviet Socialist Republic declares Estonia as sovereign, but stopped short of declaring independence from the Soviet Socialist Republic. 1988, the first open election in more than a decade, voters in Pakistan elect populist candidate Benazir Bhutto to be the Prime Minister of Pakistan. 1989, El Salvadoran army troops kill 6 Jesuit priests and 2 others at Jose Simeon Canas University. 1990, pop group Milli Vanilli stripped at her Grammy Award because the duo didn't sing at all on the Girl You Know It's True album. Session musicians provided all the vocals, even though the 2 that made up Milli Vanilli were given the awards. 1992, the Hawks hoard is discovered by metal detectorist Eric Laws in Hawks, Suffolk. Now, the Hawks, or H-O-X-N-E, or maybe it's Hoxney, is the largest hoard of late Roman silver and gold ever discovered in Britain. and the largest collection of gold and silver coins of the 4th and 5th centuries found anywhere within the Roman Empire. It was 14,865 Roman gold, silver, and bronze coins, and about 200 items of silver tableware and gold jewelry. The objects are now in the British Museum in London, where the most important pieces and a selection of the rest are on permanent display. In 1993, the Treasure Valuation Committee valued the hoard at £1.75 million, roughly equivalent to £3.59 million in 2019. It was buried in a small oak box with items of precious metal, sorted mainly by type, with some in smaller wooden boxes and others in bags or wrapped in fabric. The coins date after AD 407, which coincides with the end of Britain as a Roman province. Now, why the owners buried it isn't known, but it was carefully packed and the contents appear consistent with a single very wealthy family. Likely, the hoard represents only a part of the wealth of its owner, given the lack of large silver serving vessels or some of the more common types of jewelry. But it's interesting that things like that are still popping up. And in 1997, after nearly 18 years of incarceration, the People's Republic of China releases Wei Jingxing, a pro-democracy dissident, from jail for medical reasons. Well, in 42 BC, Tiberius, the Roman emperor, was born. He died in 37 AD. There's a large number of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, Africus, Agnes of Assisi, Edmund of Abington, Elfric of Abington, Eucharius of Lyon, Gertrude the Great in the Roman Catholic Church, Giuseppe Mascotti, Gobrain, Hugh of Lincoln, Margaret of Scotland, Matthew the Evangelist in the Eastern Christianity, Othmar, Our Lady of the Gate of Dawn, Roque Gonzalez, Juan de Castillo, and Alonso Rodriguez, Day of Declaration of Sovereignty in Estonia, earliest day on which the date of repentance and prayer can fall, November 22nd is the latest. It's always celebrated 11 days before Advent Sunday in the Lutheran, Reformed, Calvinist, and United Protestant churches in Saxony and Bavaria. In Germany, it's the Volkssturmtag, Icelandic Language Day in Iceland, International Day for Tolerance in the United Nations, that's a laugh, and Stadia Day in St. Eustatius, that's the Caribbean Netherlands. See if there's anything else of any interest. In 13 A.D., General Tiberius, who later became Emperor Tiberius, made his triumphant procession through Rome after the siege of Germany. 1380, French King Charles VI declares no taxes forever. 1519, the city of Havana, Cuba, moves to its current location to avoid mosquito infestations. 1572, troops under Don Frederick, the Spanish general Frederick Alvarez de Toledo, occupy and plunder Zutphen in the Netherlands. 1581, Tsar Ivan the Terrible attacks his son and heir, Ivan Ivanovich, with a scepter after an argument leading to the son's death 3 days later. 1669, the French state funeral for Henrietta Maria, Princess of France, widow of English King Charles I at St. Denis, with the famous oration by Bishop Jacques Benet Bossuet. And in 1676, the first colonial prison organized at Nantucket in Massachusetts.
'Alright. Well, that's our history for today. You know, there's a lot of places that can be said to be lost in time. You know, on the surface, ghost towns as such have nothing in common.
Motion detected at the front door.
Other than the fact that they were abandoned for whatever reason. Some were once royal residences in the Far East. Others were rustic mining camps in the American West. Some were deserted over the course of many years. Some died virtually overnight. And a handful were destroyed due to all too human errors. Asbestos poisoning, nuclear meltdown, civil war, things such as that. Though most have well-documented past, few remain shrouded in mystery. Their ancient secrets lost in the midst of time. One fort in India was supposedly cursed by a tantric magician. One Italian castle is allegedly the site of a mass murder spurred on by one man's obsessive love. And despite their considerable differences, many of these communities have histories that seem to come right out of adventure stories. We're going to talk about wandering ghosts and vengeful barons and lost fortunes. Let's go to start out in Bannock, Montana. You know, many of Bannock's buildings, including the schoolhouse that served as a Masonic hall, still have furniture inside. And some are said to be haunted, including the Hotel Mead, where the ghost of a drowned girl has been seen a number of times. You know, on July 28, 1862, prospector John White discovered gold in Grasshopper Creek, what's now southwestern Montana. That find, of course, attracted a flood of prospectors to the unincorporated area. It became known as Bannock, Montana's first boom town and territory's first capital. By the spring of 1863, the town had a population of 3,000 and a growing reputation for the lawlessness that came to epitomize the Wild West. Bannock Sheriff Henry Plummer was an ex-con and recently spent time in California's San Quentin State Prison. And according to the local lore, he was the leader of a gang known as the Innocents, who had hijacked gold shipments on the stagecoach en route between Bannock and Virginia City. Supposedly killed over 100 people in the process. Although Plummer's guilt was never proved, a group of locals called the Montana Vigilantes hung the sheriff and two deputies on January 1864. But there was one fly in that particular ointment. Before he died, 27-year-old Plummer claimed he'd hidden his weight in gold in an unknown spot. If the vigilantes would give him 2 hours head start on horseback, he'd bring it back. Of course, 2 hours had given the lawman plenty of time to escape, so the vigilantes hung him anyway. Contemporary historians have questioned these accounts, suggesting that Plummer was innocent, and the stories are, in the words of one biographer, fabulous tales created in an attempt to exonerate the vigilantes, as well as increased newspaper sales, of course. Nevertheless, news of the supposed treasure sparked a furious, if ultimately futile, search. Thanks to Bannock's explosive expansion, President Abraham Lincoln officially established the Montana Territory in 1864. But gold was becoming harder to find, and prospectors moved on to richer lodes. Mining in Bannock continued until the 1930s, when a depleted town became a state park in 1954, and it's now a National Historic Landmark. More than 60 well-preserved buildings still remain on the site, and Sheriff Plummer's legendary goal continues to attract fortune hunters, including one local named William Japp, who's convinced the treasure is hidden in multiple locations between Virginia City and Bannock. As he said, nobody'd bury all their eggs in one basket. If you go to Bannock and explore the ruins, you'll find an old barber shop and what's left of a hotel and even a rusting car. It's somewhat unique among America's ghost towns, and that most of its 60-some surviving structures can still be explored by the public. Who knows what you'll find? Well, let's go to Kayakoy in Turkey. In 1916, a Turkish magistrate told displaced Greek Christians, "Your race will be destroyed." He threatened them with genocide if they didn't convert to Islam. All the Greeks refused, according to the Greek Genocide Resource Center. Beginning in the 14th century, Anatolian Muslims and Greek Orthodox Christians cohabited peacefully in the mountainside town of Levice, known as Kayakoy, located in the Taurus Mountains of southern Turkey's Kaya Valley. The area comprised two settlements. The Christians, who made up most of the population, lived on the hillside. The Muslims inhabited the valley. Over time, the population grew to 20,000, but the relative harmony ended in 1914 with the outbreak of World War I. That led to widespread Turkish persecution of the Greeks. Hundreds of Greeks were murdered during these offensives, according to the Greek Genocide Resource Center. Women were raped and their clothes and shoes taken from them. By 1918, Kayakoy was almost entirely deserted. 1923, after the Greco-Turkish War ended with the defeat of Greece, the Treaty of Lausanne instituted a compulsory population exchange that forced Turks out of Greece and Greeks out of Turkey. The Turks, who were forced to relocate from Greece to Kayakoy, found a windy, arid area inhospitable and were cowed by the rumors it was haunted by the ghosts of the Greeks who'd been slaughtered there. So they eventually moved on to what they thought were greener pastures. 1957, a 7.1 magnitude earthquake destroyed most of Kayakoy's structures, and the area was abandoned. 1988.
Motion detected at the front door.
The Turkish ministry designated the Kayakoy remains as an archaeological site and turned it into an outdoor museum. Later, it became a filming location for The Water Diviner. That was Russell Crowe's 2015 directorial debut. Now two decaying Greek Orthodox churches, a 17th century fountain, and 350 roofless homes are all that remain of a place that proved for a while that people from very different cultures and traditions could live in peace. Until the radicals on both sides raise their ugly heads. And let's talk about the Bokor Hill Station in Cambodia. The Bokor Palace Hotel opened in 1925. And according to Marguerite Duras, a French novelist, fur framed the women's faces. Then a resident of Kampot, Duras compared the lavish structure to a winter palace in Côte d'Azur. In the early 1900s, constructions began on Bokor Hill Station, a luxury resort perched atop Bokor Mountain in southern Cambodia's Nam Bokor National Park. Built for French colonists, or colonialists, as a respite from the sweltering jungle, the Cité de Bokor included a Catholic church, a post office, and a lavish Bokor Palace Hotel. That was a 38-room establishment that opened with a dance and a six-course meal on Valentine's Day in 1925. On the menu for that particular meal were foie gras, chantilly cream, and strawberries, which were considered delicacies in those days in that area. By moonlight, during one of these starry nights, which Cambodia is so famous for, the poetic enchantment seems to belong to things truly out of this world, according to one visitor. After the first Indochina War broke out in the mid-1940s, the French left the area and the Bokor Palace Hotel became a military hospital. Well, difficult to defend, it was abandoned once again in 1950 and remained empty until 1962. When another lavish party marked the hotel's grand reopening. Before long, the complex became a popular destination for government officials and business people, often from the West. Cambodians didn't go to Bokor itself, according to Marie-Francoise Chatel, a former professor at a school from nearby Kampot. Bokor was mysterious and made people a little afraid. A more tangible kind of fear spread from the Khmer Rouge when they took power in 1975. A brutal communist regime soon commandeered the Bokor Palace Hotel, where Chandeliers still hung from the ceilings and the paintings adorned the walls. According to one Campot resident, they killed people in the casino. There was blood on the walls. Some people's hands were cut off. Now, the Khmer Rouge bloody reign ended after 4 years. The hotel remains a communist stronghold to the early 1990s, when it was taken over by the United Nations with the assistance of French soldiers. 2012 and 2018, respectively, two new hotels were built on the property, but the ruins of the old settlement still remain. They are considered lingering reminders of the otherworldly things that once danced in the Cambodian moonlight. You know, unfortunately, the jealousy of those who rightly or wrongly believe they've been held down periodically erupts. And you have bloodletting like you wouldn't believe. Well, let's talk about Deception Island in Antarctica. One early explorer described the approach to Deception Island as traveling through the mouth of the dragon into the spacious harbor. It's eventually dubbed Port Foster after the British captain Henry Foster arrived on the island in 1829. You know, back in the 1800s, Antarctic seals were prized for their thick, sleek fur, particularly by the Chinese, whose demand for the pelt sparked a killing frenzy in the polar seas. One of the most important sealing stations, as it was called, was a desolate place in the remote South Shetland Islands known as Deception, a sunken but still active volcano whose 10-mile crater serves as a natural harbor. Dubbed Port Foster, the harbor was an ideal anchorage and shelter from brutal storms for the sealing ships. Thanks to its narrow entrance, which led into a passage known as Neptune's Bellows, the caldera was virtually invisible from the ocean. The island appears solid from the outside till that opening is found and it's discovered to be a flooded caldera, according to photographer Acacia Johnson. It's an amazing passage to sail through, with walls of rock rising up on both sides. Also, a submerged rock right in the middle of the channel that's caused many a shipwreck. By the early 1900s, overhunting had devastated the local seal population and the sealers abandoned Deception Island. But a new hunt began in 1906 when a Norwegian sailor established a Hector whaling station at the aptly named Whaler's Bay, a cove just inside Neptune's Bellows. By 1908, Deception had three whaling stations. Its water's teeming with factory ships, and its geothermically heated beach crowded with storage tanks and blubber-extracting boilers. This operation flourished till 1931 when declining oil prices and new whaling techniques caused another human exodus, leaving the island to its native colony of chinstrap penguins. During World War II, the British established a military base on Deception, and Chile and Argentina followed suit, but volcanic eruptions that began in 1967 ended human civilization on the outpost for good. Now nothing remains of the seal hunting on Deception, but decaying whaling boats still float at Port Foster, and the Hector station was left of a structure called Base B are protected as historic monuments. According to Johnson, the ruins reflect a rare time when we can see and understand traces of human presence and industry in the Antarctic region. Today, the only humans on Deception Island are the tourists who take thermal baths on the volcanic beach. And the whales and the seals have returned, and the chin-strap penguins continue to flourish on the island's eastern headlands. You know, during very various periods of its occupation, Deception Island had dormitories, a store, an aircraft hangar, and a graveyard. Established during the whaling period, the cemetery was ultimately destroyed by volcanic activity. You can see where it was, and it's marked by a plaque. Well, let's go to Golden Mountain in Krakow, Italy, located in a part of southern Italy known as Midday, which to this day remains more rural and desolate than the northern part of the country. This is a fact that contributes to the ghost town's eerie ambiance. Built on a cliff overlooking the Cavone River in southern Italy's Basilicata region, the village of Cracco was founded in the year 1000 as a lookout post by the Normans, who erected the striking tower that still crowns the town as the defense against Saracen invaders. Over the centuries, the place known as the Golden Mountain became an important military, monastic, and educational center, but it weathered, often literally, a share of hardships. In 1656, the Black Death decimated the city's population, while Italian unification in the early 19th century led to social upheavals. Brigands ravaged the city till the mid-1860s, and the lack of economic opportunity forced many residents to leave for America. In the end, though, Cracco was undone by the elements. In the mid-20th century, frequent earthquakes, floods, and landslides began to undermine the town's already unstable terrain. Process likely hastened by the hand of what people referred to laughingly as progress. Though Cracco's first settlement had been built on bedrock, as the population grew, new structures and a heavy water tank were built on unstable clay. In 1963, a landslide wiped out half the town, forcing 1,800 inhabitants into the nearby locality of Cracco Pizzeria. Some hardy residents remained in the old village till a 1980 earthquake finally reduced it to a ghost town. Today, you can see the ruins of its palaces, churches, and the Norman Tower that make Cracco a popular location for movie shoots. Mel Gibson filmed some scenes from The Passion of Christ there. And it's a destination for pilgrims to come to venerate an important Catholic relic, the Hand of San Vincenzo Materi, a Roman soldier and martyr who is the town's patron saint. Due to ongoing seismic activity, that relic's been moved to a new church in Sant'Angelo, a small settlement on top of the cliff, and the only place that's still inhabited in the ghost town of Basilicata. Well, let's go back to the U.S. for this next one. In Colorado, Animas Forks. Though Animas Forks was already in decline at the time, a fire that started in the kitchen of the Kalamazoo House Hotel pretty much finished off the town on October 22, 1891. Soon the post office closed and most of the people left. See, in 1873, the Bruneau Agreement, a land exchange between the Native American Ute tribe and the U.S. government, opened southwest Colorado's San Juan Mountains to mining operations. 2 years later, the town of Animas Forks, originally called Three Forks of the Animas, was founded near the confluence of three rivers at an altitude of 11,200 feet. Unlike many mining boom towns, Animas Forks is driven more by speculation than product. The mill was built by the Dakota and San Juan Mining Company in 1876, and it produced little more than what passed for hype in the Colorado Rockies at the time. But the appearance of success led to actual success, and speculative outside investment eventually funded three general stores, a butcher shop, a restaurant, a saloon, a sawmill, two boarding houses, including one run by Esther Eckard, the town's first female resident, and the Kalamazoo House, a hotel that boasted a piano and the town's only telephone. In the early 1880s, the town reportedly had a population of about 400. It also had a jail, a school, a general store, a butcher, a water-powered sawmill, and the Animas Forks Pioneer, a newspaper with the highest altitude printing plant in the U.S. history. Well, life in Animas Forks was often punishing, though. In the early years, the harsh, high-altitude winters forced many residents to travel 12 miles south of the town of Silverton every fall. Those that stayed behind faced considerable risk. In 1884, a 23-day blizzard buried the town in 25 feet of snow. Locals had to dig tunnels to get from building to building. And by 1910, the mining had pretty much dried up, and Animas Forks became a ghost town by 1920. Most of the old town's buildings were destroyed by fires and storms and time, but the nine remaining structures still attract travelers along Colorado's scenic alpine loop. And you never know if you go exploring what you're going to find. Well, let's talk about how the West was sold. You know, late 1880s, Calico, California flourished during the largest silver strike in the state's history. But when that metal began to be depleted, the town went into a decline. Calico saw a renaissance of sorts in the 1950s thanks to Walter Knott, who purchased it and restored most of its original buildings. The town helped inspire Knott's Berry Farm, the popular theme park in Buena Park, California, which features areas called Ghost Town and the beloved town of Calico. An event called Ghost Town Alive offers what the park's website calls bandits, cowboys, robberies, judges, and a good old Western hoedown. They call it the Mild West. Cashing in on the past is hardly unique in the U.S. In addition to the tourists who crowded such tragic sites as France's Orador Sur Clain and Sicily's Pagoyo Reale, many abandoned European and Asian communities are often used as movie sets. In the 2012 James Bond film Skyfall, it was filmed in the ruins of Japan's Hashima Island, and the crumbling remains of Krakow served as a location for Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ in 2004. Now, all this selling of the old West isn't necessarily a bad thing, since influx of cash helps keep these towns on the map. Many instances, such as Tombstone, Jerome, and Oatman in Arizona, commercialization was key to survival, according to Jim Hickney, who wrote Ghost Towns of the West. Without the tourists and their romanticized vision of the Western frontier and their ghost town, many of these towns would have survived into the modern area, would be a little more than ruins among the tumbleweeds in the sand. The ghost town of Calico is now a tourist destination where offers include sweet shops and Granny's Calico Crafts. And, of course, they have the hanging booth during vigilante days in Tombstone, Arizona. I've been to Tombstone a number of times. It's quite an interesting place. Then in Spain, we have the haunted battleground of Belchite. The grandson of one survivor of the Belchite slaughter, which claimed to have reported 5,000 lives, said that his grandmother never liked to talk about it much. Nobody in Spain likes to talk about the Civil War. Too many memories. In 1936, fascist-backed nationalists in the Spanish army revolted against the government, and against the communist-led Republican government specifically, sparking the Spanish Civil War. During three bloody years that followed, the town of Belchite, strategically located in the northeast province of Aragon, became a punching bag. The Republicans seized the town to prevent the Nationalists from conquering the northern provinces, leading to the Battle of Belchite, which began August 24, 1937, which ended with the Nationalists, led by General Francisco Franco, prevailed in September of that year. In the wake of the struggle, the bodies of thousands of residents, many of them starved to death or systematically shot, were stacked in the town square, doused with gasoline, and burned. Some were dumped in wells designed to hold olive oil. The town itself was so totally ruined that often one could not tell where the streets had been, according to historian Cecil Ebby. People were digging into piles of mortar, brick, and beams, pulling out corpses. Mule carcasses, cooking pots, framed lithographs, sewing machines, all covered with flies, made a surreal collage. Belchite became less a town than a nasty smell. The first months of 1939, Franco took control of Spain. Rather than demolish what remained of the town, the dictator decided to let the ruins stand as tangible proof of his power. Today, there's nothing left of Belchite but an old metal cross, the shells of empty houses, and the bullet-ridden cathedral, and the distant echoes of the tragic past. Some visitors claim to hear ghosts of the victims crying in the rubble. One area resident said there are many voices and things you can hear sometimes at night. People hear different things. Ghosts, yes, of course, more sad than frightening, but what do you expect, really, when you know what happened here? And they've got a good point. When that many people die, it does raise many, many issues to consider. Well, let's talk about Oradour Seguin, 1953. 21 of the SS soldiers who had destroyed Oradour and his people were put on trial, which was complicated by the fact that 14 of them were from Alsace, France. And though all were eventually pardoned, their varying verdicts included execution, forced labor, imprisonment, and acquittal. It all began on the afternoon of June 10, 1944. 200 members of Nazi Germany's 2nd Waffen SS Panzer Division, the Das Reich, arrived in Oradour Seguin, a French farming village not far from Limoges, began systematically wiping it off the face of the earth. On the pretext of a simple ID check, villagers were herded into the Champ de Floyd, the town's main square. One survivor later said, "We were laughing, we weren't afraid, we were thinking of the next day's soccer match." And humor soon turned to fear when the Nazis led the 197 men to 6 barns and took the 240 women and 205 children into the church. After securing the doors, the SS men torched the barns, threw explosives into the church, and dynamited the rest of the town. They killed any stragglers they found with machine guns or grenades, firing first into the church and firing burst out in the church in straw, and the chairs were thrown pell-mell on the bodies lying on the stone slabs. That's according to one survivor. Said he had escaped from the killing and was without injury, so had me use of a smoke cloud to slip behind the altar. Nobody really knows why the Germans attacked the town. Some say it was revenge against the French resistance. 2 days after the Allied forces' D-Day invasion and 2 days before the massacre, Nazi Field Marshal Gerhard von Rundstedt ordered his soldiers to crush freedom fighters in southern France with the greatest severity and without leniency. Now, this town was hardly an obvious target. Many of its residents had never even seen a German, but that didn't matter to the soldiers of Das Reich. In the end, the worst Nazi atrocity on French soil left 642 innocent villagers dead. Most of them so badly burned and mutilated they could never be identified. Only 7 survived. Thanks to an edict from then-general and future French President Charles de Gaulle, Oradour remains the only town leveled by the Nazis that had been entirely obliterated. Also known as the Martyred Village, it attracts 300,000 visitors a year, including Robert Hibras, who was in his teens when he survived the massacre by hiding under a pile of dead bodies. "And there's a school bell hanging up there," he said, reminding me how I was always late. He made that comment while touring the ruins with Guardian in 2013. In the rubble, you can also see a sewing machine, the car that belonged to the village mayor, the old butcher shop, and a church whose walls were stained with unspeakable carnage. But time and weather have taken a toll, despite ongoing preservation efforts on the part of the French government. One survivor said there's a real need to keep these ruins standing for future generations. They haven't lost their authenticity. They still serve to show where certain criminal ideologies can lead, what humans can do to fellow humans. That need is wrenchingly reflected by the Center of Memory, a nearby underground museum that tells the story of the tragedy. In a bilingual town at the town's entrance, it says, "Souvenez toi, remember." Oradour Seguin, unchanged since the day of the massacre, evokes by the very silence of its empty streets and shops, its abandoned cars and shattered church, what can only be described as the anguish of ghosts. Thomas Cook wrote a book called Even Darkness Sings about the world's most tragic sights. But for Hibras, the survivor, the town remains a land of the living. He says, "When I come here, I see faces and people, not ghosts." It's now part of this town, which is known as the Martyred Village, is now part of France's tourist industry. With TripAdvisor critics complaining the dogs aren't allowed, warning potential visitors about noise. Well, let's talk about the Emerald City. Mutu Tawain in China. Built in the 1950s on a cliff on Xingshan Island off China's east coast, the fishing village of Hutuan quickly expanded along with China's fishing industry. Its population peaking at about 3,000 in the 1990s. Then one day, he said, something happened. Redis began leaving. An exodus that left the town abandoned by 2002. And no one knows why this happened. Though competition with technologically superior fisheries nearby Shanghai, China's largest city, may have rendered the old-fashioned angling obsolete, which is not uncommon in today's small Chinese villages. Globalization likely contributed as well, making a tiny town seem tinier than ever and spurring local dissatisfaction with substandard education, erratic food delivery. And with the humans gone, nature, of course, took over, covering Hutuan's abandoned houses with a carpet of bright green vegetation that led some to associate the spot with the Wizard of Oz's Emerald City. Others called it a Ruinkun, or No Person Village. Though time had clearly forgotten the town, the internet didn't. 2015 photos of the ivory-choked village went viral, attracting an influx of tourists. At first, the island residents tried to discourage visitors. One official at the time said our telephone lines were jammed and we're getting more tourists to Hutuan. It's not equipped with the conditions to open to tourists, but their money proved impossible to ignore. Before long, some of the town's houses and the main road had been rebuilt. A bed and breakfast opened nearby, and Hutuan officially welcomed visitors. Even in its new life as a tourist attraction, it faces competition from Shanghai, where the world's largest Starbucks opened in 2017. Sort of an amusement park with coffee as theater, which became a massive hit in the tradition in tea-drinking republic. Well, let's talk about Epicuan in Argentina. It's the modern-day Atlantis. Only one man, 89-year-old Pablo Novak, still lives in Villa Epicuan, which was once home to more than 1,500. Many locals moved to nearby Charhue after the rising lake waters destroyed the town. Broken staircase leading nowhere, the ruins of a salt-bleached slaughterhouse, and a plethora of decaying buildings and rusty cars, all that remain of Villa Epicuan.
Motion detected at the front door.
A once prosperous resort spa, roughly 335 miles from Buenos Aires. First developed in the early 1920s, the area remained best known for the Lago Epicuan, a mountain lake with saline waters, saltier than any oceans, that were considered therapeutic by vacationers seeking aquatic cures. And many Jewish tourists were attracted by the lake's similarity to Jerusalem's Dead Sea, one of the saltiest bodies of water in the world. At its peak in the 1970s, Villa Epicuan had roughly 5,000 residents and attracted about 20,000 tourists each summer. But its fortunes, as well as the city, began to sink. Unusually high levels of rain inundated the nearby hills. Over the years, the precipitation continued, and Lago Epicuan's waters rose steadily until the freak weather pattern caused a standing wave to form in 1985. When it broke the dam, the waters began flooding the town at roughly half an inch an hour. Norman Berg, a former resident who now serves as an area guide, said, "We woke up with the water up to our ankles. We packed what we could and we left. Everybody just assumed it'd be temporary, but it wasn't. Within weeks, the water was 3 feet deep. People had been preparing for months for the upcoming summer season. Many had invested time and money in new fixtures and remodeling work. Those who could took absolutely everything from their personal belongings to the kitchen sink. By 1993, the water had risen to about 30 feet, submerging the abandoned resort like a latter-day Atlantis. Now, over time, of course, the rain waned, and in 2009, the water began to recede, exposing the town's salt-covered ruins. And these days, the area is showing signs of resurgence. An eco-friendly resort fueled by solar panels opened on the lake in 2015, and a museum housed in the former train station displays personal items salvaged from the lost town. Record players, old clothes, and other mundane but moving reminders of life in this long vanished village. Let's talk about the Italian Las Vegas. Consano in Italy. Consano's always a party, according to the sign at the entrance to the abandoned town in the hills of Brianza, north of Milan. But it hadn't always been that way. Consano began life as a small medieval village where farmers harvested celery, leeks, and chestnuts. Of course, that all changed in 1962 when the Italian economic boom led Count Mario Bagno, an entrepreneur known for building airports and roads, to turn the site into a city of toys, sort of Italian Las Vegas. After purchasing Consano for 22.5 million lira, about $32 million today, he forced its inhabitants out and began bulldozing buildings, and he left behind nothing but the church, the graveyard, and the chaplain's house. Though the City of Toys proved popular when it opened to the public in the late 60s, the party ended in 1976 when a landslide cut off access and the attraction was closed. Well, Bagno briefly considered turning his white elephant into an old age facility in the 1980s, but his vision remained unrealized when he died in 1995. In a 2007 rave, partiers destroyed some of the town's surviving buildings, prompting officials to labor to no trespass zone. Though its outdoor grounds played host to the Nascondino World Hide and Seek Championship in September 2017. Well, the Bagno dynamited Consano's mountainside to provide a better view of the Italian Alps, and that triggered landslides in 1966 and 67. The town survived, somewhat. It became home to a Chinese pagoda, a castle, casinos, bars, and hotels. And now it's a home to Ghost in the Wind. Well, excuse me. Let's look at North Brother Island in New York. Located between what's now Rikers Island and in the borough of the Bronx in New York City's East River, North Brother Island was discovered by a Dutch captain in the early 1600s. 20-acre island remained uninhabited until 1885 when Riverside Hospital was built on its shores to quarantine victims of smallpox. That contagious disease was ravaging New York City at the time. Eventually, the facility treated hundreds of patients, the most notorious of whom was Mary Mullen, known as Typhoid Mary. She spread the disease. She applied her culinary skills throughout the city. She died of pneumonia in 1938, and not long after that, the hospital closed. A casualty of the public health program. On June 15, 1904, North Brother Island became the site of New York's worst disaster before 9/11 when the General Slocum, a chartered paddle-wheeler carrying 1,358 German-American church members from the city's Lower East Side, was engulfed by a fire so fierce that trying to contain it was like trying to put out hell itself, according to the captain. The boats rotted life vests, and lifeboats proved useless, and many passengers, mostly women and children, couldn't swim. Though the Slocum eventually reached North Brother Island, where bodies laid out on the shore, only 321 people survived. And on that note, we come to the end of tonight's show. We've run out of time. Until tomorrow at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.